From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, Entertainment Weekly film critic Chris Nashwadi, is not only a fan of film, but of popular culture and sports in general. His book on the making of Caddyshack got its origins in a Sports Illustrated piece he did, an oral history of Caddyshack. It's a terrific book, and Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Elvis.
It's funny because I just remember talking to you about this when you were doing the oral history. Is that kind of where the book comes from?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, let me backtrack by saying that I think as a film critic, people expect you, your favorite movies to be Vertigo or Eight and a Half or, you know, some Akira Kurosawa movie. And I love all that stuff. Don't get me wrong. But I have a real soft spot in my heart for movies like Caddyshack and Stripes and John Hughes movies.
Major League.
And this is one of the movies that's dearest to me. Yes, it did originate as a oral history in Sports Illustrated in 2010, I think it was. And I just, as I was reporting it and talking to the stars of the movie and the people behind the scenes, I just realized that as great as this movie is, the making of story of this movie is so much better than the movie itself. Between just the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of it all, just a really interesting time in Hollywood at the late 70s, and just in American comedy in general.
Yeah, because the book is also about the National Lampoon and Saturday Night Live. Just, it's really a look at, it's a window inside American comedy of the period as much as it is a look at the movie, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to capture a 10-year period in American comedy that sort of culminates with Caddyshack. You know, it starts off with the National Lampoon, and then it sort of segues into the Second City scene in Chicago, and then the birth of Saturday Night Live, and how that sort of leads into Animal House, which brings us to Caddyshack. And that generation of satirists that were fueling that era of comedy, they really changed the idea of what a Hollywood comedy was. Because before movies like Animal House and Caddyshack, it was very Smokey and the Bandit, which is a fine movie, but not...
I don't know if I go that far, but okay. Well,
it's not as... It doesn't have as much to say, I think, as the sort of slobs versus snobs, class comedy, sort of Saturday Night Live influenced comedies that came after.
It's funny because that stuff really strikes me as almost like the 70s drug version of what the Marx Brothers were doing,
right,
with George S. Kaufman, because there was an attack on institutions, basically sort of saying that the people with money weren't really the people to pay attention to, the institutions shouldn't be trusted, and all that kind of ethos really came to the fore in these comedies, didn't it?
Yeah, and I think Harold Ramis has always referred to Caddyshack as a Marx Brothers comedy. I forget which particular Marx brother he associates with the four main characters in the film, but you know, that Roddy Dangerfield, I believe, was Groucho. You know, I couldn't tell you who was who exactly.
I can tell
you. Please,
because Ted Knight would be Zeppo.
Okay.
Basically, Bill Murray would be Chico, and Chevy's kind of Harpo.
Okay. Well, there you go. And it's you know, Ramis was a huge, the Marx Brothers were the biggest influence on his career and his whole philosophy of comedy to begin with. And when I did interview him before his death a couple of times, he kept referring to this movie as my Marx Brothers movie. So yeah, I think that's a really dead-on observation.
But it's interesting because this movie comes together in such a fascinating way. I mean, it seems like it's a bunch of amateurs, but as you mentioned, the DP, it worked with Terrence Malick. There are a lot of people working below the line, the production designer who kind of had a Hollywood history as well, who sort of knew what they were doing, but you had this weird collection of amateurs and professionals.
Yeah, I mean, there were some grown-ups in the film, you know, on the film, but they weren't in positions of real power. You know, the producer on the movie, Doug Kenny, who had helped write Caddyshack.
And one of the creators of the National Lampoon.
That's right, yeah. I mean, he was, at the time that they were shooting Caddyshack, pretty heavy into cocaine addiction. So you've got sort of the fox guarding the hen house on the set of this movie. They're shooting in Florida, which is pretty much the gateway to America for cocaine in 1979. And it's sort of There were not the traditional checks and balances on this film that you would expect from a studio movie. Yes, the DP had some credits, you know. Yes, the production designer was a guy who had experience. But in general, these were people who were baby boomers who were looking to have some fun. And it's amazing that with all the partying, a movie actually got made.
It's true. We're talking about the making of Caddyshack with the author of the terrific book, Chris Nashwadi, a movie that survived John Peters, Ted Knight, and a hurricane.
That's right. Yeah, the opening weekend of shooting, there was Hurricane David blew into town and destroyed a bunch of sets.
But that's good because they were going to destroy stuff anyway. But for me, some of the most interesting stuff, and Ramis told me some of these things, he told me about what it was like when he was Rodney Dangerfield, basically consulted with him for the rest of his life. Whenever Rodney was making a movie, he would call Harold and work it out with him. And you have a section I'd like you to read about Rodney Dangerfield's method of working on the movie.
Okay, here we go. But now that he was experiencing a miraculous late career surge, maybe it was time to leverage his newfound popularity and see what this acting racket was all about. Caddyshack seemed like an ideal showcase made to order for his unique brand of off-the-cuff patter. Not only did the filmmaker make their fandom flatteringly plain to him, they seemed to understand his limitations and weren't remotely put off by them. The character of Al Cervic, a super-rich Bulgarian blowhard condominium developer, didn't have a lot of lines in the first draft of the script. But if anything, that made Dangerfield more confident about accepting the part. It was a juicy, glorified cameo. He didn't have to carry the movie, he could be carried by it, popping into the frame, dropping a couple of crass rimshot one-liners, and waltzing off as suddenly as he appeared. He thought, I can do this. Dangerfield's first scene in Caddyshack comes midway through the first act, when he pulls up to Bushwood in a fire engine red Rolls Royce with the custom Cervic Illinois license plates and a horn that blares, "We're in the money." With his silent Nikon-snapping stereotype sidekick Wang riding shotgun, he steps out of the convertible like a Tex Avery sight gag, wearing a white golf hat, red leisure slacks, a white belt fighting a losing battle with his gut, a lime green shirt, and a rainbow cardigan sweater. He peels off a gaudy tip for a valet from an obscene amount of bills and instructs him to park my car, get the bags, and gain some weight, will ya? As the hard-charging bull walks into the Bushwood Pro Shop, Cervic turns to his pal and cracks, I think this place is restricted, Wang, so don't tell him you're Jewish. Okay, fine. Ramis and his crew had spent the morning of Dangerfield's first day of work dressing the set. Brian Doyle Murray had become a stickler on making every aspect of Bushwood, even a place as incidental and unimportant as the Pro Shop, look as authentic as possible. Each set was like a diorama, replicating his youth, like his own personal rosebud. For Dangerfield's first shot in the film, the comedian was supposed to wait behind a door until Ramis said, action. Then he would barrel into the Pro Shop with Wang, as if he owned the joint, introduce himself, and rattle off all of the pricey equipment he wanted to buy. 10 of this, 20 of this, the whole schmear. Finally, out of the corner of his eye, he would spot a mannequin wearing an ugly pastel-striped golf hat and say, this is the worst-looking hat I ever saw. Meanwhile, just behind him, off to Dangerfield's right, Knight's Judge Smells, wearing the very hat, fumes a slow burn for the ages. Dangerfield notices and says, oh, it looks good on you, though, as he turns his head and rolls his big bug eyes.
That's a fun section, by the way. But also what's fun about that section, too, is you go into the fact that he didn't really know how to respond to the word action.
Yeah, he didn't know what action meant, that was his cue. In the scene that I just read about, he was behind a door, and he had to barrel in and do the scene. And Ramis called action, and nothing, crickets. I mean, Rodney just stood behind the door, and Ramis said, Rodney, are you okay? He's like, yeah, I'm fine. And he's like, okay, when I say action, that's your cue to come in. So he calls action a second time. Nothing. Rodney doesn't move. Rodney, is everything okay? When I call action, that's your cue to come in. Oh, you mean do my bit? And he says, yeah, do your bit. So the next time instead of calling action, he just says, okay, Rodney, do your bit. And that's how it went for the rest of the movie. Every time Rodney was in a scene, it was, okay, Rodney, do your bit. That was his action.
And the story of the movie is that in following these actors, each one of them basically contributes and writes the movie in his own. Basically, each of the actors is writing his own separate movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's so. The beauty of having Harold Ramis, as inexperienced as he was, directing this movie is that he welcomed ideas because of his Second City training, from anyone. I mean, you could be a way below the line sort of production assistant and say, like, you know, it'd be really funny here. Do this. And Ramis would think about it and actually weigh it. And if it was good, he'd use it. So, yeah, I mean, Bill Murray especially sort of created his character out of whole cloth. But all of them, I mean, Chevy Chase, Dangerfield, the only one who really did not veer off of the script was Ted Knight.
Who, as you mentioned in the book, basically his fuming sort of became a real part of the character.
Yeah, it's like method anger. he hated the way they all worked. I mean, Ted Knight was a professionally trained actor who had, you know, been on 7 seasons of Mary Tyler Moore Show and been nominated for 6 Emmys and, you know, was really, not to be understated, a tremendous
No, he got
a serious actor.
He actually did this terrific, weird old movie, this thriller that Robert Altman directed. I mean, so he did all kinds of things. He was played a German tank commander. And
yeah.
He did all kinds of things.
Yeah. He's in Psycho.
Yes.
Yeah. But Ted Knight's way of working was stick to the script. You know,
as you mentioned, and especially in doing sitcoms, like something as intricately choreographed as Mary Tyler Moore,
yeah.
You had to be on point.
Yeah, and you had to crank out, you know, 12 pages a day. I mean, they really, you know, they moved. And so, you know, doing a scene for him with Rodney Dangerfield, who's just making up everything that, you know, shoots into his head, he just couldn't keep up. He didn't know how to deal with that. That was like, you know, it might as well have been Greek to him. And it made him irate. He really just thought that he was trapped on a movie set with a bunch of stoned 20-year-olds and just was completely out of his element.
What do you remember about the first time you saw Caddyshack?
You know, I was in the glory days of VHS, and, you know, like so many movies that I saw probably between the ages of 10 and 13, it was wildly inappropriate to be seen at that age. I loved it from the get-go. I thought it was hilarious, and I think I always just really was most dialed into the Bill Murray character. And it's funny that if you go back now and look at the reviews for the movie, they were mixed to negative.
It was also generational too,
yeah.
Too, because a lot of people just didn't get it.
Right. The critics were much older than the sort of target audience for this movie. But the one they singled out most positively in all of those reviews was Rodney Dangerfield, who had been slaying on The Tonight Show at the time. I mean, he was really as hot as Dangerfield ever was. But Bill Murray's character, Carl Spackler, the assistant greenskeeper, is really people just really have a hostile reaction to him. And it's if I was Bill Murray reading these reviews, not that I would think that Bill Murray ever read a review in his life, it would be soul-crushing. I mean, he's really singled out in these reviews as being just a reprehensible character. But, you know, to 10-year-old me, this was heaven.
My guest is Chris Nashwadi, film critic for Entertainment Weekly. His book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're talking about the book Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story, with its author, Entertainment Weekly film critic, Chris Nashwadi. And one of the things I've just found myself really interested by that you get into is kind of an aside, but it's really what this movie is about, and so many great movies are about, is the idea of improvised lines. And you go through a litany of lines that were improvised in movies, such as Roy Scheider saying, "We got to get a bigger boat." I mean, and I just love that you're building film history into this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is, in a way, this is a very important step in film history, I think. You know, if you're a fan of comedy, Caddyshack and Animal House, which came out 2 years prior, largely with the same creative team behind it, those are a step in a new direction, sort of a satiric, in a way, much sort of more scalpel-sharp version of satire than movies had really had since really the 30s, I think. And so The whole idea of improving so much of this movie is also a radical departure, because although movie history is full of scenes where lines are improvised, or like certain expression, you know, you talking to me in Taxi Driver, that's improvised. You know, like I said, you're going to need a bigger boat from Jaws, or even, you know, the mashed potato zit scene from Animal House, leave the gun, take the cannoli from The Godfather. I mean, you know, some of the most important, you know, memorable lines in movie history are improvised. But this is a movie that went far beyond employing an improv line here and there. The whole real style of this movie is improvisation. When they went down to Florida to shoot this movie, there was a script. They really did not stick to it at all. In fact, the movie was supposed to be about Danny Noonan, Michael O'Keefe's caddy character, and his Irish Rose love at the, you know, who was the waitress at the golf course. They're the heart of the movie, and these crazy characters were sort of orbiting around them. But it just wasn't fun. Like, they had to follow the funny on this movie. And what Chevy Chase and Rodney Dangerfield and Ted Knight and Bill Murray were giving them every day, just out of whole cloth, inventing it on the fly, was the gold. And so they had to sort of rejigger the movie at the last minute and say, we got to follow the funny stuff. Let's leave this love story off to the side. And that really gave them a lot of headaches in the editing room.
What's interesting, too, is that this movie is the beginning in comedy, and you get to it here, and you also got to it in your other pieces, of a real anti-sentimental streak in comedy. And part of it, what the movie success is about, is that rejection of that storyline you were talking about, which is a real old-school kind of story that probably every other Robbie Benson movie was about in the 70s.
right.
And these guys kind of recognizing instinctively, but then really seeing as they're shooting, is that that story was immaterial. And once you've got talent of this caliber, the story itself is immaterial.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, the style of comedy that was on the rise in 1979 when this movie shot was very anti-sentimental. It was also just anarchic and sort of political, and it spoke really directly to a generation that had never really seen itself reflected on TV before, or in the movies for that matter.
And not by people of that generation. Those are few and far between.
Yeah.
A few movies maybe like American Graffiti, but for the most part,
yeah,
that generation hadn't been seen in movies written by their contemporaries.
For sure. And what movies did exist at the time, you know, when we think of the new Hollywood movies of the 70s, movies by Scorsese and De Palma and Altman, I mean, those movies did reflect the audience, you know, the college kids and whatever, and they flocked to those movies. However, there's very few comedies in there. I mean, those were really earnest movies.
And also, too, one of the things that these movies that I think you're attracted to about are movies that are a take on heroism. I mean,
right,
if you look at Major League or this movie, there are new heroes being created in this, heroes who are rejecting the status quo but have a lot of confidence about rejecting that status quo.
That's really interesting. I hadn't given that much thought, but that's a really interesting point. Now you're making me feel like I wish I had included more about that in the book.
But I know you for a while, and this the thing that unites these things in many movies that we've talked about are just these heroes, and even for Doug Kenny here,
yeah,
and the way he talks about Chevy Chase, I mean, for me it's implicit in that, so you didn't really have to state it, is the kind of person that Chevy Chase was, and we've learned maybe some parts that should be rejected now,
yeah,
but that guy who was completely confident at all times is this guy that these guys all, to some extent, kind of yearn to be. That's Otter in Animal House.
Mm-hmm.
It's Jake in Major League. I mean, again, a lot of these movies that we've talked about that you're a fan of are these guys who aren't conventional heroes but still occupy the center of the film as if they are heroes. And these movies by Scorsese and Altman, these Hal Ashby movies, don't have that kind of conventional heroic stamp or the heroic stamp in general.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I do think the time of these movies, the late 70s, is a time when so much is in flux. You know, what about what a hero really is, what, you know, a happy ending really means, what good and bad are. And I think that so many people would draw a huge, bold neon line between movies like the new Hollywood movies that we were just talking about, Scorsese, Altman, et cetera, and sort of this, you know, souffle light comedy, Caddyshack. But I really would argue that it's in some ways really part of the same movement. And, you know, it doesn't wear the stakes so so much on its sleeve, but through comedy, they are getting at stuff about class and power that the more earnest movies from the 70s were a little more obvious about, I think.
Well, it's a Cinderella story. And we're talking right. about the book Caddyshack, the making of a Cinderella story. See, we do segues here with my guest, Chris Nashawaty, the author of the book and a film critic at Entertainment Weekly. One of the things I found really touching about the book, and I'm glad you put it in here, something that a lot of people don't know, is just how much enthralled Bill Murray was to Henry Will Conkson, who was a serious actor. And you can just see, and to some extent, he is kind of following him like a puppy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful part of the book, I thought. It was the most unexpected thing. I mean, Bill Murray, you know how hard it is to get in touch with Bill Murray.
Tell me about this.
Yeah, right? Can I tell this story?
Yes.
Okay. So I had a really hard time. Bill Murray does not have, for those of you who don't know, Bill Murray does not have the traditional Hollywood mechanism of a publicist or, you know, someone who, you know, conveys interview requests to him. He has, what he has is a 1-800 number, which is pretty hard to get a hold of. And I had a hard time making this interview request because I didn't have the number. So I asked a friend.
Okay.
May I?
Yes.
Okay, Elvis. Gave me the number. And so I called Bill and I left him a message every day for about a month, taking a variety of tacks. Like, you know, oh boy, am I such a fan of Quick Change, you know, the movie he directed, thinking that would be an easy way into, you know, to his ego or whatever. I'm not proud of the way I stalked him. But eventually, I think with your help, he did give me a call back late one night, and with the sound of tinkling ice cubes and what can I only imagine is a nice highball I heard in the background, Bill Murray began to grant me an interview, and he couldn't have been more generous with his time, and he also could not have been more introspective and sort of sentimental about this movie, which people joke about Caddyshack, but it gave so many people's careers starts. And I think he felt indebted to it in a way. And I think he also felt a little sentimental about his relationship with Harold, which had sort of become very rocky. And so he told me this story about Henry Will Coxon, who plays, you know, the bishop in the movie and who gets struck by lightning. And
I mean, if you're a movie person, you see the credits and you see Henry Will Coxon's name, it's kind of shocking just because he is about the last person you expect to see in something like
Absolutely. This. And you would think that someone like Henry Will Coxon, who had been one of the biggest stars of the 1930s, he was really the Olivier of the 30s, he would look at a script like Caddyshack and toss it aside. But obviously, you know, he knew a good part when he saw one, and it's not like Hollywood was beating down his door. But when Bill Murray met him on the set, he didn't really know who he was. But when he talked to him and found out who he was like, holy moly, this guy in our midst is a much bigger deal than any of us realize. And he really gave Bill a lot of advice about acting, recommending some books and techniques. And this is stuff that Bill admitted that he still uses to this day.
And he told Bill, the thing is, I remember him telling me this, you have to learn to listen.
Right.
Because Bill would show up so revved up and ready to do stuff. And it's a difference in performance terms between Bill and Rodney Dangerfield, who's not listening to anybody. And part of what's going on with Carlos, he's actually, and you can see in that weird improv scene with Chevy Chase in the shed, he's actually listening to him.
Yeah, that's, I was actually just going to bring that up to explain. Yes, you nailed it. If you look at a movie like Meatballs, which is the movie that Bill made prior to this, it's a lot of showboating. And there's a lot of improv in that movie,
too. He's
not
even looking at Chris McPeace in the face.
No.
He's looking right past him.
Right. He's doing shtick. In this movie, especially the scene you just mentioned with Chevy Chase, it's their one scene together. That is classic Second City improv. They are listening to each other. They are saying yes, and they are following each other's cues. And they are seeing where this is going to go. And it's tremendous. And they did that in maybe two takes. And they had no script. They had just hashed out what the scene was going to be a couple hours earlier in the trailer over lunch.
And we should also say, too, there had been tension between them because Bill was the guy who came in to replace Chevy, didn't quite have his footing for the first year of the show, and they almost came to blows when the point when Chevy Chase had come back to host the
show.
They did
come to blows. Yeah, it was in 1978. Chevy Chase had, you know, gone out to Hollywood, left SNL, and become a bit of a star, and I think also had become a bit of a star in his own head. And when he came back to SNL, I think there was a lot of resentment about, you know, you left us, you abandoned us, and you went on to greener pastures, and sort of there was some hurt feelings, especially by Belushi. And Bill Murray became, as the new guy, sort of became the avenging angel who really provoked Chevy into what became a fist fight right shortly before they went on the air. And they had to pull him apart, and those guys did not have a good history at all. And I think when they both arrived on the set of this movie in Florida, there was a lot of concern about whether or not they were going to be able to. They didn't initially have any scenes together, but they were on set at the same time. I think there was a lot of concern that these two, it could get a little frosty, you know. And this one scene that they have together, I think thawed a lot of the ice between them. Because both of them, when I interviewed them, talked about how impressed they were by the other one in that scene. And it's just a classic scene.
It's funny because when Ramis was making that Marx Brothers comparison, I said, well, it always felt to me like Ted Knight was the Margaret Dumont
of the movie. Right, exactly.
The one who didn't quite get what was going on but was determined to be in it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
When you pitched this book, what was the response? I mean, because part of me wants to think, well, they got it right away, but I could see people going, you want to do a book about Caddyshack?
Yeah, I mean, I have a hard time explaining that to people. I don't think that they think that it's a movie that can carry a whole book. I should make it clear that in a 300-page book, we don't even get to Caddyshack until around page 150.
It's like you said in the first half, it's really a look at the history of comedy of that period, slicing through, because of the glue that holds it all together, and the glue doesn't really survive till the end of the picture,
right,
is Doug Kenny.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's sort of the heart of the book and the through line of the book, the tragic figure of the book, and I find his story just to be so fascinating. But yeah, I think the Caddyshack stuff is what the book is about, but I like to think it's about more than that. So in describing, telling people, yes, it's a book about Caddyshack, but trust me, it's a book about more, you know.
Did people get it when you were first going out to pitch, or how'd that work?
They did. You know, I think this movie falls into a certain sweet spot where, yes, it does take some explaining, but it's one of these movies where even if you don't love it, you know someone who loves it, and you know someone who quotes it, or you've been at a cocktail party where if you hear someone saying a line from the movie, you immediately know that they're a kindred spirit. It's one of those movies. It's a mainstream movie, but it feels like a cult movie because people have taken it so much to their hearts. So I was lucky enough to find a publisher who really felt the same way about the movie, and saw the potential of the book. So, yeah, that's the long answer to that.
That's okay. It's the kind of answer I want. Nobody listens to the show to hear me. I'm sorry we are out of time. There's so much we didn't get into, but it's a great book, and I'm so thrilled you're able to come at such short notice to talk about it. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you, Elvis. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. And it'll be your pleasure to read the book. The book is Caddyshack, The Making of a Cinderella Story. Its author is Chris Nashwat. He's film critic at Entertainment Weekly. Recording engineer here at Hargrove Studios in New York is Ivan Currier. The show is mixed by Kat Yores, edited by Blake Pipes, associate producer. I'm not going to go get laid. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.